Session number 11766, Mr. T.H. Harville, Reel 2.
Mr. Harville, Reel 2.
It would have split the forces if it had been successful. It drove a wedge straight into the Montgomery's army. And he sent out an SOS for a strike. When we got near the target, the master bomber was down at up and above treetop height in a mosquito, and we came in at 11,000 feet, and he called out basement 4, bomb low basement 4, which meant that he wanted us to come down to 4,000 feet to bomb. But it was too late. I mean, say we were nearly on top of the target. So Skipper said, "We're going down." He said, I said, "If you put the wheels down and the flaps, we're going to drop quicker. And when we get down there and in good position to drop the bombs." So that's what we did. Wheels down, flaps down. And it was quite a sight to look up and see the bombs raining down. And fortunately, the bombs were ahead of us, you know. Anyway, went in and bombed and got out of it quick. It was silly, really, because it was sitting target for light flak, you know. And as it was, one of our squadron that was up 11,000 feet got a direct hit.
Was there much flak coming up?
Not a lot. It was mostly light flak, but they must have had one or two heavy guns there to have hit the length from our squadron.
Was there any fighter opposition?
No, we... there was, although we weren't closely escorted, there was fighters, Spitfires and that in the area. So I suppose they were watching over us, you know.
How long did it all last?
Oh, we were soon in and out. We went straight in, as we, you know, came at low level, and well, the 4,000 feet, we call that low level, and the bomb aimer had a good sight of the target. And dropped the bombs, and we got out back over the lines, because the front line wasn't far away, you know.
What could you actually see on the ground when you dropped the bombs?
Well, by that stage, the burst, the smoke in that from the burst, as the main force had dropped their bombs by then, you know. It must have been quite successful, because when we returned to the squadron, there was a signal there from Bomber Harris. He'd had a signal from Montgomery thanking for the doing such a good job. And of course there was no attack by the 6th and 8th Panzer Division that night, or very much doubt whether there was money left to do much attacking.
Were the V1 attacks at night or in daytime?
We did a couple in daytime, but most of them were at night. And there were losses at night, despite the fact it was in the Pas de Calais, quite just over the coast. There were still fighter airfields, night fighter fields, in north of France, you know.
How much work did you have as a flight engineer on these operations to do?
Well, the most important, I suppose, it was to monitor the fuel consumption. Because the gauges, although you had fuel gauges, you keep a fuel log, working out the consumption of fuel by reading the gauges and that, and keeping a close watch on it, and then transferring. You had 6 tanks, you know, so that was the most important job. Because these Lancaster 2s, I think some of them, were quite a few might have been lost, were running out of petrol, because they could be very greedy on petrol, as opposed to the 1s and 3s with the Merlins. And on a long haul, like when we went to Stuttgart one night, an 8-hour trip, it would be quite easy to run out of fuel before you got back to your own home station.
How did going to a German city like Stuttgart compare with the raids on France?
Oh, it's different altogether. So it's, you know, I know, strange to say, but when I went to Stuttgart, and of course we were going back the second time, and I was shot down a couple of nights later. But it was the most successful attack of the war, because on Stuttgart, that is, it had been bombed quite a few times over the period of the war. But it's built in a series of narrow valleys, and it's very difficult to concentrate the bombing. Anyway, it was the 26th, 27th. It was two nights before we got shot down. And as we came in over Stuttgart, the fires were burning, you know, it was a massive, you know, flames. You could see that the bombing had really decimated the place. Even that stage, as we went in, there were other bombers to follow. And strange to say, but you get this feeling of exhilaration. Although a certain apprehension, because they had the flaming onions there, which were weird.
What were they?
Well, they were at night, you know, all you'd see was balls of fire coming up, series of balls of fire coming up at you, and they would come lazily off out of the ground, from the ground, and as they got closer, they'd gather speed and then burst, you know. I suppose it was phosphorus coated shells, you know, but at night, that's what they called them, flame onions, who like balls of fire.
Can you now describe in detail the raid in which your plane was lost?
Yes. There was one other operation against the German city, it was Kiel.
Yes, if you can tell me about that first.
Well, after we bombed Kiel on the Sunday night, and we come behind a bank of radar, and actually the Germans were deceived, because they thought it was just a few bombers mine laying, because they did a lot of mine laying around, obviously around the North Sea and that, and they jammed the German radar, and then suddenly several hundred bombers came from behind the screen of jamming straight over Kiel, and it was quite a successful raid. So it was, the losses were moderate, and that's when the next night we switched down to Stuttgart, and that was that big raid I told you about just now. And the losses were moderate then, because the thing is about 3% of the force, because it caught the Germans on the hop switching from Kiel to Stuttgart. But the night we got shot down, the Germans weren't going to be deceived again, and it was a bad night. It was there was 440. It was all Lancaster. A show that one. There was 494 Lancasters, and out of that, 39 were shot down, in which it was 38% of the force. Well, on the average, losses worked out at 5%. That was quite a heavy night, you know, a bad night. I'd, oddly enough, I had apprehension about that night before we took off, and so did the skipper. You could see it. He was, you know, there was something about him, you know, and he was on edge, and things went wrong. When we did a pre-flight inspection, there was a piece of wire fixed on one of the airlines, that an inspection tab had been on it, you know. It wouldn't have caused any bother, you know, no harm. Anyhow, he got upset about that, and then when we got on board and did a brief flight run up, the accumulators were flat. They had to be replaced. It was all a rush job, and he was threatening to put the ground staff on a charge. And when we were actually taken off, it was dark then, and we were going down the runway, and the only microphones that should be on was his and mine, because it was the timing of the pulling up the wheels, which was my job, and the flaps by degrees, you know, it was all had to be coordinated with him, otherwise you'd probably flop with a load of bombs and fuel and end up in a real a burner, you know. So somebody in the crew had their microphone on and was picking up the sound of the engines, and of course it was coming over the intercom, and he was shouting to me, and I, you know, let's do this, that and the other, and the routine, you know, the wheels, the undercarriage and the flaps, and it really upset him, you know, but he really let off about it. Quite understandable, you know, it's a crucial moment, especially when you reach the point of no return down the runway, and you can't afford to have anything go wrong. So by the time we got airborne, you know, there was sort of an atmosphere that, well, I found it, and he certainly did. Anyhow, it was a long haul ahead. It was going to be an 8-hour flight there and back. We flew across Normandy, and we were right there, beachhead, you know, in the Normandy battlefield. We weren't getting any flak from there. So we could relax a bit until we come south of Paris, and that was a bad spot, you know, for fighters and that. But we were in cloud, so I was a bit comforted in that respect. When we got over as far as Lorraine, that was where I was shot down just before we came to Lorraine. We were flying 11,000 feet. We had to come up 14,000 feet. So we climbed and came out in the bright, stark moonlight. It was a night fighter's dream, that, you know. Massive bombers, bright moonlight. And that's counted for the losses, I think, most of them. There was one went down, that one, I know from a cemetery near where I was shot down, there was a crew shot down the same night. They were buried there, the whole crew. Anyhow, just as we came up into the moonlight, there was a bit of light fleck, and the skipper, he told me to go down in the bomb aimer's compartment and throw out a bit of window, you know, the strips of silver paper too, because the radar protected guns, throw them off the aiming. But the rear gunner called up. He said he could see fighter flares in the distance. And I thought, well, it was quite unnecessary to go down the throw window, because if fighters are coming in amongst the stream, you know, the AK gunners are not going to fire. Anyhow, he wanted me to do this, so I went down, and I sat on a glycol tank, and as I went down, I took a parachute out and took it down with me. The mere thought that those fighters were in amongst the stream, you know, I thought, well, I'm not going to be left in the nose without a parachute, because it's a struggle from my height now to get down into the bomb aimer's compartment. And if I had to get back up to get my parachute, seconds can make all the difference between life and death, you know. Although I wasn't worried. I wasn't consciously thinking about all this, you know, I just taking it by common sense, I suppose, taking it as far as she was like. As it turned out, it did prove common sense. Anyway, I put the couple of bundles of wind away, and I think that's what drew the night fighter onto us. Because we have a Liechtenstein radar, which pick up the aircraft, the bombers. But a snowstorm of window coming down, you know, it's going to light up his radar screen. And I think he hadn't been on it. But suddenly there was a clatter of the cannon shells. It was cannon shells bursting. And they were coming in from the starboard flying quarter. Because I looked over to the port, out of the, couldn't see out other than the bombers' observation window, and the tracers were going off the port. Anyway, I heard the crackle of our guns, one of the mid uppers or air cannon must have fired, and then there was another burst of cannon fire, and then this glow and over to port. So I thought, well, that's the port outer on fire, and I wished I was up in the cockpit, because the drill was that I would have shut the engine down, feathered the air screw, and actuated the fire extinguishers that are on the engines. But there was I stuck down in the bomb arms compartment. I heard the rumble of the hydraulics, and I was going to go back up in the cockpit, and she suddenly lifted, and I realised the bombs are gone. And the skipper said, he called up the bomb aimer, he said, I've dropped the bomb safe, he says, because they weren't fused in that stage, because the bomb aimer fuses them with the switches when he approached the target. And she was going down then, she started, you know, I could feel her, you know. And the skipper suddenly came over the intercom, bit about eight boys, lads, he says. And but she was going on a steeper dive then, and in front of me was the escape hatch. There's two toggles. He pulls his toggles, pulling up the escape hatch. And I tried to bend down to do this, but the force of G was so great, I was being pushed back. And an odd sort of thought went through my mind. I'm in the nose, and I should be the first one to be killed, because when it's occurring, it's not an odd thing to go through your mind. Of course, I also thought about this port outer, because I knew I had about 30 seconds for the flames to burn through the spar into the petrol tank behind, and that would have gone up. And as it did, I felt a rush of air, and I can't remember, I must have. I pitched forward and I smashed my head against something, and I can't remember if possibly the bomb aimer's observation window blew out or what, or I managed to pull the toggles, I don't know. But next thing I knew, I was falling through the cold air, you know, and I sort of realized after a few seconds I must be falling through the air. I looked down and looked about me, and then I thought the obvious thing to do is pull the toggle of the parachute instead of airborne. When the parachute opened, I could look down then, by then the aircraft, I could see it burning on the ground. Then I looked up, and there was burning debris falling my canopy down. Yeah, this stage, I think, saved me from being a prisoner of war. I pulled hard on one strap to spill some air out so I could drift sideways. And when I came down, I come down in a plow field, but it was hard, you know, because obviously it was summertime, and it was baked hard, and I had a bad landing. But elect the wood between me and the aircraft. Now, unknown to me, the only other person to get out was the navigator. He's got an escape hatch above his table. But it's not for bailing out, it's for ditching. Because if you bail out of there, you have a pretty good risk of breaking your back on the mid-upper turret or on one of the tail fins. Anyhow, he successfully bailed out from there. And he landed quite close to where the aircraft was burning. And there were Germans in the town, Neufchâteau, quite close. And he was captured. My leg was all was twisted, my head was bleeding, and I pulled my chute into a wood, into the wood, and did my best to hide it behind some bushes. And I went into the wood, and there was a tree that was easily climbable, and I climbed up the tree. Anyway, I stayed there for a long time, and I could hear dogs barking and voices. So I don't know, they were seeing me come down in the moonlight, probably they did. But anyway, they didn't come in my direction. And after, I must have been up there about half hour or so, I climbed down and made my way out of the wood, opposite way from the aircraft, where the aircraft was burning. And I found myself on a road. Anyway, I saw a... As it was, there was a signpost there, 60 kilometre, a Nancy.
To where?
Nancy. So that put me in a... I knew we were must have been south of Nancy, and that put me approximately where we were. Actually, where I did come down was... where the aircraft came down was Domremy, the birthplace of Joan of Arc. So I crawled up a bank in that and onto the road, and there was a ditch. So I lay down in the ditch to rest and sort of think about things, you know. And, I'd been there a short while, and I see a chap pushing a bicycle from the direction of the... where the aircraft had been burning, you know, the torture. And he had a berry bass, so I thought, well, I'm right here as a Frenchman. As he came level where I was lying in the ditch, I just stood up and I said, on RAF. So he looked frightened because obviously I just had the battle dress bows, trousers, and black flying boots. It must look like a jackboot, you know, a German jackboot. And I said, RAF, repeated that and pointed to the aircraft, you know. Well, he threw his arms around me and he supported me because I could only drag him off with one leg, you know. And he took me to his home, which was in a nearby village. Broncor.
How do you spell that?
It's BRANCOURT, Broncor. And we stayed in the shadows out, you know, before he knocked. It was an old, very old house, a very old village, you know. And he tapped on the door and he said something about collaborator. He pointed across the cobbles. Street, you know. And
how much French did you understand at that time?
None at all. I knew collaborator, you know, because it was so well used. But funny enough, he spoke just the odd word of English he picked up, because he was an infirmier, a male nurse in a local hospital, and they'd had hospital over the years. He had tourists in there, you know, before the war. And he picked up probably the odd word of English, but not enough to have a conversation. His wife let us in, and he had two children, two babies, and he was taking a terrible risk, as I'm saying, I only had my life to lose, but he had the wife, the lives of his himself, his wife, and his two children, because if I'd have been found there, they'd have ended up in a concentration camp without a doubt. And he, of course, being a malnourished, he was able to treat my wound in the head, and sort of looked at my leg and that. And it was one of these old houses that had a hayloft. So he took me up there after giving me some food, and I spent several days there in this hayloft. And he would take me out at night into the garden to do my functions, you know. And twice he brought me notes in English. I'm never sure who they came from. It was probably it's been written by the daughter of the surgeon who he worked for, you know, or one of the daughters, because they both speak fluent English. They did then, obviously. And he told me to give myself up. So I read the notes, and no. And I had these silk maps, escape kit, which every flyer carries, you know, on Bomber Command. It's a plastic case, and it contains silk maps of Holland, France, Orlix tablets, you know, they keep you going, and some currency. So each time, you know, I'd get out the silk map, and I'd point to Switzerland, and I'd say, Switzerland, Switzerland. So he must have gone back and reported that I wanted to go to Switzerland, and I wouldn't be turned from it. And while I was up in this hayloft, a couple of Germans came to the door, and they wanted to buy some eggs. And they asked Charles, that's his name, you know, the chap, Charles Lang. They asked him if he knew of anybody hiding an airman. They'd found a parachute, you know, and there was an airman hiding somewhere. Because he never knew, couldn't help them at all, you know. I think it was on the fourth day, he brought me one of his old suits. Fortunately, he was tall, like himself, and although the navy blue suit, an old thing, you know, it dangled a little bit where my ankles were, you know, it didn't quite get into my shoes, it was presentable, you know. And he gave me a berry basque to put on, and he had a friend with him called Bernard, somebody from the village. They both had bicycles, with a spare bicycle for myself, so I went with them. Much to their apprehension, I was cycling on the wrong side of the road, and so I put that right, and then I'd had some chewing gum from the escape kit, and I was chewing that, so that was out. I had to spit that out, because a Frenchman, they just didn't chew gum in those days. They didn't have gum to chew in any case. Then we come to the Neuf Chateau, the main town there. And my crew was buried in the cemetery. Five members of the crew there. As we parked our bikes against the cemetery wall, and there was a German soldier standing there with a rifle over his shoulder. And I thought to myself that, you know, he was so scruffy, you know. You know, I thought, well, that's the German army. First of all, I'd seen a German soldier, obviously. And I thought, well, he could make a name for himself.